Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We had planned to go to Chattanooga Wednesday night, but weather prevented us, and so we didn't get to go. Instead, everybody just got a night off, but the sleet and freezing rain and everything on the I-24 between here and Chattanooga just was not an inviting drive. I called Jeff and said, I just spoke to David. He said, it's snowing in Chattanooga. So that's a clue. So we quick called each other and said, oh, all right, let's not go. And I hope you used your time wisely. We are in the book of Luke. We ended chapter 17 last week, but we're going to pick up today in chapter 21. Because the parallel passage to the second half of Luke 17 is Matthew 24. Matthew 24 is sort of an amalgam of the second half of Luke 17 and Luke 21. So Luke took all the information in Matthew 24 and included it in his gospel in two different parts, both of which are on the journey toward Jerusalem, but Luke included some other material in between his two tellings of this material of the return of Christ, whereas Matthew put it all together in one passage. So we're going to look at Luke's version of it, then we're going to look at Matthew's version of it, and the first thing that's going to jump out at you is that Luke leaves out certain parts. Like, Luke doesn't mention the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Matthew mentions that. Luke doesn't. And it's because, as we talked about last week, Matthew's writing to Jews. Jews who would have actually had the book of Daniel to refer to. Luke's writing to Gentiles. Gentiles who wouldn't have known Daniel the prophet. So to include that information for them wouldn't have had any great value to them. They wouldn't have been able to relate to any of that. So you're going to see a few of those kind of details that Matthew includes that Luke doesn't. And it's interesting, the stuff that Luke chose to leave out of his telling of Jesus talking about his return. So the subject here is Christ's return. We're starting in Luke 21, verse 5. The first four verses just have to do with what's commonly called the widow's mites. It's completely unrelated to our topic, so we'll just skip those four verses for the moment, and then as we work our way verse by verse through Luke, we'll go back next week, pick up at, well, 2 weeks from now. Okay, 3 weeks from now. At some point, we'll get back to Luke 18, and we'll go forward from there. Luke 21, starting at verse 5. And as some spoke of the temple, this is the temple that was built by Herod. This is the second temple. This is not the Solomon temple. The Solomon temple had already been destroyed. And so Herod, who was not technically Jewish, he was an Idumean, and he was really a puppet of the Roman Empire, in order to gain favor and curry favor with the Jews in the domain that he ruled over, he put a lot of time and money into building a lot of things in Jerusalem, not just this temple, which historically is said to be an absolutely magnificent thing. But Herod also built a great many things. He built a causeway, a harbor, a man-made harbor outside of Caesarea that is one of the great architectural wonders of the ancient world. And so he put a lot of time and money into building and construction. So to any Jew, they were very, very proud of this temple that they had to worship in. Now, Herod the Great, built that temple. That's the same Herod who had tried to destroy Jesus by killing all of the children 2 years and under. You're familiar with that from the Christmas story. Now, his son took over after him, Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was not anywhere near as industrious as his father, was much more likely to kind of lay back on his money and enjoy his life. However, it is Herod Antipas, Herod the son, that Jesus is going to be sent in front of over the course of being shuffled back and forth between the Jews and the Gentiles on the night of his betrayal. So you got all that? All right, so now they go into Jerusalem and they see this magnificent temple and they want Jesus to be impressed with the temple. And some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts. And Jesus said, verse 6, "As for these things which you behold, the days will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now that's quite a specific prophecy. This is a place where you can really check him and see if he's actually a prophet, because he walks into this magnificent, widely known, very famous building, this temple, and he says it's going to be torn down to the degree that not one stone will be left standing on top of another stone. Completely and utterly leveled. Now that's quite a prophecy. Well, of course, we know that that came true. 70 AD, Titus the Roman general leads his armies in, and they also had heard of this magnificent temple and all the gold and all the treasures that were in the temple. So they went in there to loot and to rout the temple. And in the course of looking for more gold, the rumor spread that there was gold hidden between the stones and the walls. And so they started knocking down the walls, and they burned down the temple, and they tore it all down. And when they finished, not one stone was standing on top of another, just like Jesus said. So in 70 AD, what he predicted there actually came true. Proof, once again, that he was every bit the prophet he claimed to be. Verse 7 then says, "And they asked him, 'Master, but when shall these things be?'" That's one question. "And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass?" Now they seem to be asking him, the way Luke posed the question, it seems that they're just asking about the temple. When will the temple fall down? When will the temple be destroyed and there won't be a stone left on another? When will that all happen? Do me a favor, now keep your finger right there. Turn over to Matthew 24 and look at the way Matthew poses the question, and it will help you understand Jesus' response. Matthew 24, starting at verse 1. I'll try not to do too much flipping back and forth between these two, but we'll have to occasionally for comparison's sake. "Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the building of the temple." Remember, they're still thinking of him in terms of king, in terms of Messiah. "This is the place where you'll be worshipped. We'll set up your throne in here." All of that kind of thinking is running through their head. He wants to get rid of all of that thinking of the temple system, the sacrificial system, the Mosaic system. All of that is going to be replaced by the supremacy of Christ alone in his death, burial, and resurrection. So he's trying to get them to understand that this temple, for all its magnificence and for all the worship that goes on there, and for as much as they love it, that that's not what's important. It's going to get knocked down, it's going to be destroyed, and they're going to go back to focusing on him and him alone. So he departs the temple, his disciples come to him to show him the temple of the building, or the buildings of the temple. "And Jesus said unto him, 'See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down.' And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives," so now that means he's left the city, he's now outside the city walls, and he's sitting at the Mount of Olives, "and his disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?'" Okay, now we have a better idea of what the real question was that was before Jesus. The question before him is threefold. The question is, when will these things be? That's the knocking down of the temple. And then, what will be the sign of your return? When are we going to know that it's all wrapped up and you're going to come back in glory? What is the sign of your coming? And then what will be the sign of the end of the world? So there's a much more eschatological bent to their question than Luke indicates. And if you just take Luke's question, then Jesus launches off into end of the world language. It appears that Jesus didn't understand the question. We were talking about the temple here. Jesus, what's all the end of the world stuff? But the question, according to Matthew, has to do with the knocking down of the temple, has to do with his return in glory, setting up the kingdom, and the end of the world. All of those things predicted by the prophets in the Old Testament are what they're asking him about. Got all that? And again, this is very, very prominent in their minds. That's why the last question they asked him, after his death, burial, and resurrection, before he leaves the planet, the last thing they ever ask him in the flesh there is, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? This is very prominent in their heads. Christ set up as the Messiah, the kingdom on earth, his return in judgment, the 12 tribes regathered, and the kingdom that's been promised by all of their prophets. Very prominent in their thinking. Got all that? Back to Luke. Now we understand the question. Luke has it, verse 7, they came to him asking, Master, but when shall these things be, and what sign will there be when these things come to pass? And he said, take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am. Do your translations say, I am Christ, or I am Messiah?
I am he.
I am he. Okay. Any of those words, any of the he, the Christ, the anything, not there. Added by the translator, not in the original text. Many will come saying, I am, is what he actually said. Now, the implication is that they're going to come and say, I am somebody, I am something, I am Christ, I am. But the reason there's no unanimity on I am what is that he simply said, I am. Now, that's a very important distinction because... That's how God describes himself, exactly. I am that I am. It's a designation that God gives himself. Moses said at the burning bush, who shall I say sent me? The burning bush, the voice from the bush tells him, you go into Pharaoh and you say, let my people go so they can come out into the wilderness and worship me. And he says, well, who then should I tell Pharaoh sent me? And God's answer was, you tell him, I am sent you. It's a very important designation. God says, I am that I am, which basically means God doesn't give you rationales, reasons, and excuses for himself. He is, and that's adequate for you. The fact that he is all you need to know. I am that I am. So at one point when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, in the middle of the night, after Judas has gone to betray him, Judas comes with a bunch of soldiers, Roman soldiers, and some from the Jewish council, and they've come to take him by force. Judas goes up and kisses him, the designation, this is the one you want, since the Romans wouldn't know which one do I want. Judas says, whichever one I kiss, that's him. He approaches Jesus. Jesus says, will you betray me with a kiss, knowing everything the guy's going to do, which had to be a tad shocking to Judas. Judas goes ahead and kisses him anyway. There's depravity. And having kissed him anyway and backed away, they come up to him and they say, are you Jesus of Nazareth? And he says, I am. And because he was God incarnate in the flesh speaking the name of God, every one of them fell down. Because man does not stand in front of God when God speaks his own name. They get down. So he spoke, I am. And that's all he said. He said the proper name of God, I am. And it leveled them. And yet they were so depraved that they picked up themselves, got up on their feet, and went and took him anyway. There's depravity. Talk about God making people do things that they're going to do no matter what. Even after him displaying his power, I believe it says knock them all backwards, that they all fell down backwards, I believe is what it says. Just the force of him using his own name. So, here's what he's saying now with all that context. He says, many shall come and say, I am, making themselves God. Now, Jeff read for us this morning out of 1 Thessalonians. Those of you who have been following the Wednesday night studies, remember what Paul talked about in 2 Thessalonians where he said that that man of sin will be revealed. And remember what he'll do? Set himself up. What?
To be worshipped
in the temple, showing himself that he
is God.
Right. To be worshipped as God, showing himself that he is God. In other words, he is the I am. And so Jesus says, look, be careful. There are many who will come saying, I am. Does anybody remember the Nike ad campaign?
Just do it.
No, the one after that. I am.
I thought that was really weird too.
Yeah, they would do these different things. I am a woman. I am, you know, an athlete. I am a mother. I am. And then Nike. I am. It was like, whoa, Whoa, you might want to research that one, Nike. That was a little chilling, yeah. Especially when you put it together with, has there ever been a more fleshly phrase than just do it? I mean, come on, you know. So, in any case. Yeah, exactly. And a roll of quarters in your pocket because the mothership's coming. So, many shall come in my name, saying, see the word name? Many will come in my name, designating themselves to be me. And they will use that proper name of God. They will say, I am. And the time draws near. Go ye not, therefore, after them. But when you shall hear of wars and commotions, don't be terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not. The King James says, King James has it, is not by and by. But in other words, the end is not yet, is the way the Matthew phrase has it. So in other words, there are going to be wars, there are going to be commotions, there are going to be earthquakes in diverse places, there are going to be these troubles that come on the earth. In Matthew, they're going to be called birth pangs of a new age, a new era, the return of Christ, setting up a perfect kingdom that'll never be ended. But before that happens, the earth itself, which Paul said groans for the redemption. Remember that the earth at one time was pristine, that at the fall in the garden, one of the first things that the book of Genesis points out in terms of the earth is that for the first time, weeds and briars, thistles grew up in the ground and choked the good fruit and stuff that grew so that men would have to, by the sweat of their brow, get out there every day and work to make the good food grow. So then Paul would pick it up and say that the earth itself groans for the redemption because it itself wants to be restored to the perfection it was made in. Now that's just wonderful language. Then Luke picks it up here, talking about the whole world being restored, and says, don't go after them because there's going to be commotions. Don't be terrified. These things are going to come to pass, but the end is not yet, and nation shall rise against nation. King James's nation, I don't know what your other translations have, it's actually the Greek word ethnos, from which we get ethnic, from which we get ethnic, ethnicity. So when he says nation against nation, he's actually talking about ethnic group against ethnic group, warring against each other. And we see a lot of that going on over in the Middle East. You see a lot of tribal warfare going on all over the world. Ethnos against ethnos, people group against people group, and kingdom against kingdom. Verse 11, and great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, which will cause things like, tsunamis, which will just wipe out 500,000 people in a day. And then people will jump up and say, and God had nothing to do with that. Except that God predicted it right here. There will be in diverse places these earthquakes and famines, pestilences, fearful sights and great signs shall there be in the heaven. But before all these, okay, so now he's saying that's all going to come. Those are signs of the end. Remember they've asked, what are going to be the signs of the end and the signs of your coming? And he said, okay, first off, there's going to be trouble in the world. There's going to be wars. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be pestilences. There's going to be problems, commotions in diverse places. But that's not the end. Don't be shaken by that stuff, he said. That's not yet the end. That's just leading up to the end. Those are just the birth pangs of the new age coming. But before all that happens, and now he turns his attention, I believe, to them specifically. Because remember, he's talking privately to his apostles in the Mount of Olives, talking to them privately. He says, but before all of that, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And it shall turn to you for a testimony. Settle it, therefore, in your hearts, not to meditate beforehand what you will answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay or resist. And you shall be betrayed both by your parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends. And some of you shall they cause to be put to death. You shall be hated by all men for my name's sake. But there shall not a hair of your heads perish. That word has to do with eternal perishing, damnation. In other words, the same way God knows the number of hairs on your head, he's saying, even though you're going to be turned over and killed, You will nevertheless be saved, not a hair of your head will perish. And in your patience, possess your souls. In other words, endure all these things that are coming. And he even says, settle it therefore in your hearts. Settle it in your hearts that if you're going to follow Christ, if you're going to follow me, he says to his apostles, get ready for the fact that the world's going to hate you and that you're going to be turned over to the authorities by those who you thought loved you most. Look at the list he puts here. He says your parents, your brothers and sisters, your kinsfolk, that's aunts, uncles, cousins, your friends, and some of you, they shall cause to be put to death. So your closest relatives and friends, says he to his apostles, are going to be your worst enemies here on the planet because you have embraced me. And they're going to think that they're doing God a favor by turning you over because you've become too committed. You've become too radical. Anybody in here had that problem? You're just an extremist now. You've just gone too far now. Oh, you know, the Bible's fine, but you've just gone and made it like your whole life or something. You know, get a grip. You gotta. I was told once. Yeah, she'll hear this, so it's okay. I was told once by my mother years and years ago when I was serving in the ministry out in California. She said to me, you know, Jim, religion is fine as long as you keep it in perspective. Keep it in perspective. And my immediate answer was, in comparison to what? What are you going to compare the gospel of the salvation, your eternal, ever-living, never-dying soul, and its eternal presence with God or lake of fire? Let's see, what can I compare that to so that I can keep it in perspective? Of course, fortunately, my mom has since become as radical as I. And so, by God's grace, she's come to embrace the gospel of grace, and I'm very thankful for that. So it's okay that I can tell that story on her, and she'll call me later and yell at me. So that takes us then to verse 20. Now he's going to turn and talk about the very question, when is the temple going to fall? What's going to happen when the temple comes down? And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then you'll know that the desolation of Jerusalem is close nigh. Nigh is the word in the King James. You'll know that it's close. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of Judea depart out, and let not them that are in the outer areas, out in the countries, enter back into the city. For these be days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. Who are the this people in that verse? Now remember, he just said, Jerusalem will be surrounded by the Gentiles. So you've got the Gentile group. And then he says it's going to be a time of great distress for this people. Who are this people?
Israel,
the Jews, the folks who are actually in Judea. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. Jerusalem shall be trodden down by the Gentiles. All of this again, wrapped up in 70 AD. And then look, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That's interesting language, because he said, okay, here's the way it's going to work. He asked about the temple. The temple's going to be knocked down. And when you see the Gentiles, when you see the Roman armies encompassing it, circling it, then flee out of the city. Flee for your lives. Get out. And if you're out in the countries, don't go back in. Don't take anything with you. And then even says, woe to women who are nursing children or anything, because you're going to have to flee. You're going to have to move. You're going to have to go. You're going to have to get out. And then he says to them that those that are left in there of these people, the Jews, are going to fall by the sword. They're going to be led away captive. All of that happened in 70 AD. And Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentile until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, which is specific language that means that God has a calendar, and on that calendar there's a specific period of time during which he was going to allow Jerusalem to be overtaken by the Gentiles, which is why for a great period of time, even the Middle Eastern Turk nations took over Jerusalem, which was the beginning of the Crusades. The Crusades happened to try to go free the Holy Land from the Turkish invasion. And we've got roughly 1900 years now of Gentile dominance going on in Jerusalem. Then in 1948, Jerusalem became a nation again. Another one of those head-scratching historic moments that's really hard to understand how it is that the Jews got their nation back. Name another group of people, ethnic group of people, whoever did that, whoever lost their nation for 1900 years and then got it back. With the help of America and England and the European nations, the great gospel-based nations of the world helped Israel be reestablished as a nation, and the Jews began flocking back there. You can't find that anywhere in history, is my point. It is a completely unique, distinct event in all of human history. And now, many of you got the article that I sent you from News Daily News.
World Net Daily.
Thank you. That on April 10th, 10,000 Jews are planning to storm the Temple Mount to go back and try to reestablish their rights to the Temple Mount so they can rebuild their temple. And in that article, I found it absolutely fascinating that one of the Orthodox rabbis made the comment that there were areas of the Temple Mount that none of the Jews were allowed to go to this day and won't be allowed to return to until, and it's as close to quoting as I can come, until the third temple is built, when Messiah appears. When Messiah appears, we will rebuild the third temple. Let's see what would be the third temple. Oh, that'd be the one that takes up 8 chapters at the end of the book of Ezekiel, where there's this very vivid, physical, exact, to the dimension description of a temple that's never been built. We've never seen it on planet Earth. And yet Ezekiel predicts it's coming, it's going to be built, and you've got rabbis right now over there by the Temple Mount saying that the third temple will be rebuilt when Messiah appears. And so when Antichrist, false Messiah, appears and lets them rebuild their temple and makes the 7-year pact with them so they can rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, they will of course embrace him as the appearance of Messiah, false anti-Messiah. Of course they will, because he's going to help them rebuild their temple. Can you see all the pieces falling into place, all this stuff we've been talking about forever? Now, one more time, let me point out something really interesting. 100 years ago, if I were standing here preaching this same thing, everybody who heard me would say I was a nut. They probably still say it. But there was no Israel. Israel and Jerusalem were surrounded and overtaken by Gentiles. There was no temple over there in prefab state in warehouses waiting to go up. There was no red heifer. They have two now. There was no opportunity to restart the temple system, nor was there even a nation or a group of Jews anywhere powerful enough to begin the temple system over again. And now there is. It's all there. It's all in place. Why? Because Jesus said so. He said there will be a time when the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now that's, again, very interesting because Paul, in Romans 11, takes the time to say that the natural olive branches had been cut off so that the wild olive branches, you and me, could be grafted into that covenant. But then he says that when the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, same basic language, same basic terminology. In fact, let me get it exactly right. Look at this. Turn with me. Romans 11. Romans 11, starting at verse 25. Romans 11, starting at verse 25. For I would not have you, brethren, to be ignorant of this mystery. What's the word mystery mean here? Mysterion in the Greek, previously unrevealed truth. Something that up until Paul revealed it hadn't been revealed. Brand new information. But he didn't want us to be ignorant of it. So he wanted to make sure we knew this. And don't be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceit. Get puffed up. That blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. That again, we're talking about a calendar that God has that Luke and Matthew are going to call the times of the Gentiles, that Paul says during that time the fullness of the Gentiles will be come in to the covenant. And after that has happened, until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, how will God know that the fullness of the Gentiles has come in? Because he will have elected who comes in. He knows their names, he knows the number, he knows the full number, he knows who's coming, and when they've all come in, the door's closed. That's the end of the times of the Gentiles. That's done. Only if you understand his sovereign right, ability, and power to choose can you make these kind of statements. Which is why Paul took all of Romans 8 and 9 to take time to say, look, God chooses, he selects, it's all up to God, he predestines, he chooses, he justifies and glorifies the people he chooses. Now he goes on to say that when the fullness of the Gentiles that God has chosen have come in, he's then going to turn his attention back to Israel, verse 26, and so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion a deliverer, and he shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And you can't read that any other way. Who's Jacob? Sinning Israel. Sinning Israel. Whenever God wants to talk of Israel in their sinful state, he calls them Jacob. When he talks about them in their redeemed state, he calls them Israel. So here Paul mixes the terminology. All Israel will be saved because the deliverer is coming to Jacob. And he shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob, for this is my covenant unto them when I shall take away their sins. This is God saying, I've always promised Israel that I'm going to take away their sins. Now this is Paul talking to Roman Jews and Gentiles after the death, burial, resurrection of Christ, and he's still referring to promises God made to Israel in the Old Testament and saying this is a covenant, it's an unbreakable covenant, God's going to do it because he made that covenant. For this is the covenant that I shall make with them when I take away their sin. As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, you Gentiles. But as touching the election, they are beloved for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's sake, the Father's sake. So the Pauline theology after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ is there's going to be a time of the Gentiles, and when the fullness of the Gentiles have been brought in, God is then going to return his attention back to Israel, right where he started, and every one of the promises he ever made, he's going to fulfill in Israel. And none of that is negated by the fact that Christ came, died, raised, and went to heaven. In fact, Paul seems to be saying it's all the more firm now. Now we know how it's all going to play out. It's going to play out in such a way that Christ gets all the glory for the redemption of his people that are Gentile and his people that are Israelite. All of those people are going to be redeemed by the work of Christ. As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. Why? Because the gifts and the calling of God are without repentance, without turning from. God said it, he's going to do it. Paul said, look, he promised these people, so he can't turn from these people. He called these people, he elected these people, so he can't turn from it. He elected them, he called them, he gifted them, he gave them these promises, and he's not going to turn away from them or their promise because the gifts and the calling of God are without repentance. God doesn't change his mind. He doesn't turn from it. He doesn't go, well, I know I promised it to them, but what I really meant was, when I said Israel, I meant the church. That's what I meant. Paul here is distinguishing the church and Israel as two separate entities. Look at this, verse 30. For as you in times past, you Gentiles, have not believed in God, but have now obtained mercy through their, Israel's, unbelief, even so have these Israelites also now not believed. Remember, they're enemies for the gospel for your sake at this time. So that through your mercy they may obtain mercy, for God has concluded them all in unbelief so that he can have mercy upon all. Why were you in unbelief at some point in your life? Why were you born a sinner? Why were you born after Adam's race? Why were you born in sin? So that God could have mercy. Why are the Israelites currently in this state of temporary darkness where he said the blindness has happened in part to Israel? Why are they in this darkness for a while? So that God can have mercy on them. So that everybody who is saved the same way, by the mercy and the grace of God. He gets all the glory and he saves the same way, by mercy. And if he saves Scott individually and if he saves Israel nationally, it's just as easy for God to save one person or a mass of people. And he's going to save Scott by mercy, and he's going to save Israel by mercy, and it's all going to redound to his glory, which Paul is now going to say. Verse 33, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgment. His ways are past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has ever been his counselor, or whoever first gave something to him that it should be recompensed back to him again? For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be the glory forever. Amen. It all redounds back to the glory of God. I'm back in Luke now. So then he says that the times of the Gentiles are going to be fulfilled. Here's Luke writing before the cross. We just compared it to Paul writing after the cross, and they both agree that there's a limited amount of time where the Gentiles are going to trample down Jerusalem, and there's a limited amount of time during which Gentiles are going to be saved. And once that time is over, it's over, because the church is saved, and then the church is taken, and there is nobody left behind. Okay? Now, then he makes this leap from verse 24 to verse 25. He goes from the temple's going to fall, Jerusalem will be encompassed by Gentiles, Jerusalem will be trodden under Gentile feet until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, and then Jerusalem's going to be restored, it's going to be rebuilt, and he leaps right over in verse 25 to what it's going to be like when he returns. This is all language that, if you've been here on Wednesday nights, is all going to sound very familiar to you. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up. Lift up your heads, for your redemption draws close. Now I have to make one more comment about redemption there. He's talking about when he comes back and the times of the Gentiles are closed, that Jerusalem is trodden down and armies surrounding, enemies to this day surrounding Israel and Jerusalem, still trying to push them into the sea. That's going to go on until their true Messiah returns, and he's going to come back, regather Israel, and set up a kingdom that will never be conquered. That's the redemption he's talking about here. He's not talking about salvation. He is saying to Israelites, when you see these things, the distress in the heavens, when you see the sun go dark and the moon like sackcloth and the stars won't give their light, and then the sign of the Son of Man appears as the lightning does from the east to the west, and the sign appears in the heavens, and then men run for cover into the dens and the caves saying, fall on me, hide me from the wrath of the Lamb. He says, when all of that happens, if you're an Israelite, look up, your redemption is drawing near. He's not talking about salvation here, because the church isn't there when that all happens. Church is already gone. Church is up there with him, getting ready to come back with him. In white robes, riding white horses. We've been to the marriage supper of the Lamb. When all these events take place on earth, the church is gone. But the Israelites, when they see these things take place, he's telling them, look, take heart. You Israelites who have been encompassed about by Gentiles all this time, you will know that the times of the Gentiles have come to a close. They're no longer going to rule over Jerusalem, because the Prince of Peace is coming back to rule and reign from Jerusalem. So when you see all these signs come to pass, don't fear, don't let your heart faint, endure through it, and look up, because the redemption of Israel is drawing near. Remember what we read, what Paul wrote over in Romans 11? When he said, and I will send a redeemer to Jacob. That's what's happening here. Jacob's redeemer is coming back to bring Jacob back together and establish Israel as a nation. You understand that? So it's two different things. People get real confused there and read that and try to impose the church on it and say, well, see, then redemption, salvation doesn't happen until all those signs in the heaven and the sign of the Son of Man, and that happens midway through the tribulation, so clearly the church goes through the tribulation. And they'll also say, you know, well, it says that the Antichrist is going to deceive the very elect, if such a thing were possible, but he's going to shorten those days for the elect's sake, and that means the church. Didn't we just read out of Romans 11 that as concerning the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. Israel has always been referred to by God as his elect. So when Matthew talks about the Antichrist doing things that would deceive the very elect, there isn't a church yet. There are no Gentiles considered elect yet. The elect in all of their minds is them, the election of Israel. So don't let that language confuse you. Then he spoke a parable to them, and he said, "Behold the fig tree and all the trees. When they now shoot forth, you see and you know of your own selves that summer is close at hand. So likewise, when you see these things coming to pass, know ye that the kingdom of God is nigh at hand." The kingdom of God is nigh at hand. So now he has said two things. Your redemption draws near, and the kingdom of God draws near. You can see what Israelitish language that is. That the kingdom that's been predicted by Daniel, that will never be destroyed, is coming to earth. It's all coming near. "Verily I say unto you." Now this has caused, verse 32, has caused no end of consternation. And this is a verse that the preterists pounce on, because then Jesus says, in most all of your translations, it will probably read similar to this, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away until all be fulfilled." Do all of your translations have the word generation there? Okay, so then if you're just dealing with English words, the next thing you're going to say is, well, generation, that's 40 years. And then you'll say, well, the temple did fall within 40 years of Jesus, because Jesus died 32, 33 AD, somewhere in there. So then, yes, within 40 years, the temple fell. All of these things did come to pass within a generation. Problem is, generation is a really bad translation of that word. The word is actually in the Greek, genea. There are a lot of English words that come from that Greek word, like gene, and like genealogy. What it means, and it means it throughout the Bible, and it means it in classical Greek, take the time to go back, look it up, and spend some time studying it. What it means is groups that have similar characteristics, the same way we use it when we talk about subcategories of animals that all have similar characteristics. We call them a genus, right? All comes from this word. What it means is a group that has similar characteristics. In other words, what Jesus is actually saying in verse 32 is not this generation, as in this 40 years, but this people, which is what he has always been talking to all the way through here. These people, these Israelite people, this genus, this group of people that have the distinguishing characteristics of being Israelites will not pass away till everything he has said has been fulfilled. Now, in the last 2,000 years since he said that, plenty of people groups have disappeared. Plenty of genea have disappeared. And like I said, after 70 AD, they were scattered to the four winds, and it looked like Israel had effectively disappeared in their nationality and in their national specifications or identification. But they were always there. They always, unlike so many other people, they always kept that singularity of their heritage. There's never been a generation on planet Earth where you couldn't find people who were identified as Jews. Jewish people continued to live on planet Earth. Israelites continue to exist on planet Earth. They've forgotten who they are. They've lost their sense of nationality. They don't know their genealogy, but God knows, which is why in the book of Revelation, he can come back and find 144,000 like that. 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes is going to stamp his stamp of ownership in their forehead, and they're going to go out and preach to collective Israel with that stamp in their head. He knows who they are. The point Jesus makes here is, look, all these bad things are going to happen. You're going to be killed. You're going to be overrun. Jerusalem is going to be trodden down. All of that's going to happen. Then there's going to be famines and floods and earthquakes. There's going to be pestilences in diverse places. And you're going to be scattered all the way around the world. But this people will not stop being a people till all these things have been fulfilled. All this stuff that's going to happen is not going to eliminate Israel, which is exactly what Paul says in Romans 11. After the full number of the Gentiles have come in, then God turns his attention back to Israel, who, even though they are enemies of the gospel for the sake of the Gentiles, will nevertheless be restored by the mercy of God, because, as concerning the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. So their lost condition, their scattered condition, is no bigger problem for God than Carol's lost and scattered position. Or Robin's lost and scattered position. Anybody in this room, you did not figure God out, and there was a period in your life where you were just lost and scattered. And he found you. And he drew you. And he redeemed you. And he restored you. And don't you dare, after all that mercy, stand up and say, but he can't do it for someone else. And he can't do it for Israel. Especially after they have a whole book full of promises that says that God will do it for them. You have like minuscule promises compared to what Israel has. And yet he has saved you, redeemed you utterly and completely. So what right do you have to become what Paul would call wise in your own conceits and stand up and say, sure, he did it for me, but I refuse to believe that he'd do it for Israel. Do you get what Jesus is saying here? This group of people is not going to go away till all these things have been fulfilled. And you know what? They haven't gone away yet. And no other people group has survived the way that people group has. There's been no other people group that has suffered the sort of systematic attempts at extermination that they have gone through during the times of the Egyptians, during the times of Nebuchadnezzar, during the times of the Assyrian captivities, all these different captivities we've seen. And it's been going on right up to Hitler. Systematic extermination. And you know what? They end up a nation. They end up with their own country. And Jews coming from all over the world to come back there. It's unbelievable on the stage of history. Why? Again, it's all playing out the way it's playing out in history and time because it's exactly what Jesus said. Don't tell me the Bible's not relevant. It's very relevant to everything we're seeing going on in the world today. Okay. So take the heed to yourself, verse 34, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with, what's your translation say of verse 34 there? Surfeiting is the old English word here.
Dissipation.
What have you got?
Headaches and nausea of self-indulgence.
Okay. Overeating.
Overeating and self-indulgence and nausea of self-indulgence. Yeah, it all has to do with the same thing, which is becoming so enamored with the things of this world that you just take in the stuff of this world and forget about the spiritual things. The spiritual things become secondary to how much you can accumulate to yourself. And drunkenness, overeating, overdrinking of the stuff of this world and the cares of this life, so that that day, what day? The return of Christ should come upon you unaware. For as a snare, it will come on all them. The word snare is a trap. It's going to come like a trap on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch ye therefore and pray always, that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all the things that shall come to pass, and you'll be able to stand before the Son of Man. And in the daytime he was teaching in the temple, and at night he went out and abode in the mount that is called the Mount of Olives, and all people came early in the morning to hear him in the temple. He went into the temple and he taught them there. Now, real quickly, turn over to Matthew 24. Can I have 10 more minutes? Okay. Anybody got anywhere to be? Okay. Matthew 24, verse 1, they came and they asked him, what about the temple? Verse 3, he set upon the Mount of Olives. His disciples come to him privately. He says, take heed that no man deceive you. Many will come in my name and say that I am. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation, ethnos, shall rise against ethnos, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places, but all these are the beginning of sorrows. And I told you that the Greek word there is actually birth pangs. It's the sorrow that a woman goes through when she's waiting to be delivered. It's the same language that Jeremiah used when he talked of the tribulation, the time of the end, where he said all men walking around holding their stomachs and bending over like a woman in labor because they're in so much physical pain. The world is going to be in that kind of pain waiting to be delivered. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many will wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Now, that's another one of those verses that the free will folk like to take out of context and say, see right there, you have to actually endure to the end to be saved. You have to do it. That whole Calvinistic fifth point of perseverance of the saints, that's not true. You have to persevere. You have to do it. The church doesn't exist. He's not talking to the church. He's not talking about eternal salvation. He hasn't died, buried, resurrected yet. He is talking to Israelites who are going to endure the incursion of the Gentiles on Jerusalem. You got that? Do me a favor, Tom, as long as you, if you don't mind, I know you're writing there. Turn to Revelation 14 for a minute. Anybody else who wants to turn, you can go look at it for yourself. I just want to clear up one more misuse of a scripture. Verse 14 says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." That verse has been so maligned and misused through the years by different evangelistic groups and churches who believe that what that verse says is Jesus won't come back until the gospel has been preached all over the world. Therefore, it is incumbent on us to make sure we get out and preach the gospel to the whole world so that Jesus can come back. Because you're nodding your head, you've heard this, right? That Jesus is just up there tapping his toes, twiddling his thumbs, just waiting for us to get busy and get the gospel to the whole world, and then Jesus can finally come back. That's not at all what it's saying. They asked him, "What are going to be the signs of your return?" One of the signs of his return is that the gospel is going to be preached to the whole world and then he's going to come back. That is a sign. And if you look at Revelation 14, 6 and 7, you will see the completion of that sign where John actually sees an angel appear in heaven and preach the gospel to the whole world so that everybody's guilty because everybody's heard it. And then the tribulation ensues. So Jesus fulfills this sign, not the church. You get that? And the angel that appears in heaven in Revelation to preach that gospel is not the TBN satellite. Okay? Get that in your heads too. Read it for us, Tom, nice and loud if you would.
"Then I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He said in a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water.'"
Now there you go. That's one of the signs of the end. It's in the book of Revelation that there will be an angel in heaven preaching the eternal gospel to everyone that's on earth. And he names it. Nations, tribes, people, kindreds, people on earth are going to have that gospel preached to them. That's why Jesus would say, this gospel of the kingdom, verse 14, shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. Look at what it's doing. It is a witness that this eternal gospel has always been right, has always been there, has always been available, is the truth, is the gospel. And then shall the end come. That's the answer to the question, what are going to be the signs of the end? One of the last signs is what we just saw in Revelation, an angel appearing and preaching the everlasting gospel. "When you therefore shall see," look at verse 15. Now here's one of these things that I mentioned that Matthew talks about and quotes Jesus on, that Luke left out because it wouldn't have made any sense to his Gentile followers, or Gentile readers. Verse 15, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whosoever reads, let him understand, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not come down and take anything out of the house. Neither let him that is in the field return back in to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child and them that give suck in those days. But pray that your flight be not in winter, neither on the Sabbath day." Notice that comment. On the Sabbath day, not mentioned by Luke. Why? Gentiles aren't under the Sabbath. No point in telling them. Writing to Jews, you want to say, you better hope it's not on the Sabbath day, because the Jews aren't going to know what to do. It's the Sabbath. I can't work. I can't leave. I'm supposed to run. I'm supposed to leave. You know, they're going to have this great terror of conscience knowing what they're supposed to do. "Pray that your flight isn't in the winter. Pray that it isn't on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world till this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days shall be shortened, there would no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days are shortened. Who's elect in that verse?
Israel.
Sure. It's not talking about the church. Turn to Isaiah 45:4, somebody, real quick. Isaiah 45:4. I've referenced this many times. You might as well see it for yourself. Isaiah 45, verse 4. You got it, Scott?
I got it.
Read it.
For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee,
though thou hast not known me. Now there he's talking about Cyrus, and how Cyrus is going to let the Israelites go back. But look at what he said. He said he did it for whom?
Jacob my servant's sake.
Jacob my servant's sake.
Israel my elect.
And Israel mine elect. And then, of course, Paul says, as concerning the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. So Israel throughout the Bible is referred to as elect and chosen. So when he says here that those days will be shortened for the sake of the elect, what would his Israelite followers believe he was saying? So, oh, elect. Oh, that's us. Okay. For Israel's sake, those days will be shortened. And that's exactly what will happen. Not for the church's sake. Church is gone. Church is coming back with him. But for the elect Israelite's sake, those days will be shortened. Got that? And then if any man say to you, lo, here is Christ, or there, don't believe it. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they would deceive the very elect. Same deal. Do I have to explain this one? No. Behold, I've told you beforehand. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he's in the desert, don't go there. If they say he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it. For as the lightning comes out of the east and shines even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together, as the King James. There where the dead bodies are, that's where the birds of prey are going to be gathered. When he returns in this coming, where the lightning is from the east to the west, the Son of Man shining in the heavens, when he comes back, it produces carcasses for dead birds to eat. That's not the rapture. Right? He's coming back in judgment. He's coming back to exact vengeance. He's coming back and people are running into the caves and the rocks and the dens and saying, fall on us and hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. When he comes back in this coming, he's coming back angry. When he comes back for his church, he doesn't come back to the earth. He appears in the sky, calls us, we go up to meet him in the air, so shall we ever be with the Lord. He doesn't return to the earth at that point. He comes to get his church and we go to be with him. Completely different language than what you read here. Not the rapture. There's no rapture in Matthew 24. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, shall the sun be darkened? We should all be getting used to this language by now. The moon will not give her light. The stars will fall from the heaven. The powers of the heaven shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn when they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. That's where people say, there it is, that's the rapture. There it is, see? He comes back, and as he's coming back, he gathers his elect from the four winds, from the four corners of heaven, he gathers his elect together. See, right there. We've already established the elect here is Israel. And what will Messiah do when he comes back to establish his kingdom? Regather Israel, just like all the prophets said he would. So of course he would say, when he comes back, I will gather my elect from the four corners. That's what he's coming back to do, to regather Israel to establish his kingdom. Got all that? It's hard to readjust your head after all the traditions we've grown up with, isn't it? But there's no rapture going on there. Okay, so then he tells them the same parable of the fig tree. When you see these things come to pass, verse 34, this genea shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Verse 36, but of the day and of the hour knows no man, neither the angels of heaven, but my Father only. We came across this in Luke last week, where he said, as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. People just going about their lives, doing things, looking forward to the future, just doing their thing, and then sudden destruction came on them. And he says, that's how it's going to be when I come back. When I come back, you will not be expecting it. The day of the Lord is going to come as a thief in the night. But then Paul is very careful in the Thessalonian letter to then say to the church, but it won't fall on you as a thief, because you're not of the night, you're of the day. There's always distinction between the church and what happens to Israel. Verse 39, they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away, and so shall it be with the coming of the Son of Man. Then shall two be in the field, one shall be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding in the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you don't know the hour when your Lord shall come. That has nothing to do with the rapture. That has to do with the return of Christ in vengeance, in judgment. You can't pluck that from its natural context and say, oh, one woman taken, the other left. That's a rapture. And of course, as I showed you last week in Luke 17, his disciples asked the question, where, Lord? Where are they taken? And that's when he says, wherever the bodies are, that's where the birds of prey will be gathered. So they're not being raptured, they're taken to Armageddon and killed. That's not a rapture you want to be part of. But know this, if the good man of the house had known what time the thief was coming, he would have watched and he wouldn't have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be you ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes. I'll stop there. Now he said all of that to Israelites. Do you get that? All of that pertains to Israelites. Now it's good to know that that's all what's coming. It's good to know that the world right now, as I've stated repeatedly, is set up geopolitically in a way that the world has never been set up in the history of the world. Never in the history of the world has the Middle East been set up the way it is right now, and the alliances of the whole rest of the world. Right now, the fulcrum of world political power and the possibility of the next great world war is all focused on what happens in Israel. That's amazing. What happens in the Middle East, and that tension and all that oil, since our gas prices keep going up, all that tension going on in the Middle East is going on between God's elect, chosen people and their ancient enemies who are the descendants of Edom and Esau and have always been enemies. And to this day, 2,000 years later, the whole world is going to go to war or be at peace depending on what Jacob and Esau do. The one God loved and the one God hated. And they're still at war over there. And that's the relevancy of what's in this word to us. Now, let me say in closing, and I appreciate you staying so long, what that means to us is that the same faithful God who has continued to move nations like checkers, the same way that he did back in the time of Daniel, is still in that business, and he's still in control. There's an old statement, cheer up, saints, it's going to get worse. The world is going to continue to get more and more crazy, and the things in this world are going to become more rapidly intense if Christ is about to come. The birth pangs are going to continue to happen on planet Earth. What should we do? Be ready. Be watchful. Because before the man of sin can be revealed, we're gone. Instantaneously changed in the twinkling of an eye. This mortal will put on immortality. This corruptible will put on incorruptibility. Changed in the twinkling of an eye. We're going to be changed instantaneously, and we're going to be caught up to be with our Lord. That's the next great event to happen in the church world. The next thing that happens in Christianity is not getting the gospel preached to the whole world so that Jesus can come back. The next great thing that happens in Christianity is that Jesus comes back for his bride. And that's us. And then the times of the Gentiles are closed. Then God returns his attention to Israel. And we're up there with him looking down over the railings going, look at him, he's doing it. Look at him go. We're up there worshiping and praising God for being God and doing everything he said he was going to do exactly the way he said he was going to do it. That's the God that saved you. That's the God that has you in the palm of his hand. That's the God that loved you before the worlds began. That's the God we sing about. That's the God we praise. That's the God we come here every Sunday to talk about. That God loved you. Though he was under no obligation, he loved you, saved you, redeemed you, glorified you, killed his son for you, justified you. He's going to take you to be in heaven forever and make you joint heir with Christ in all the good things that God can pour out. That's what Christianity is about. Not all that falderal and all that silliness and the gold pianos and the women with bad hair and all that stuff. That's not Christianity. Christianity is God loved you before the foundation of the world, and he sent his son to die for you, and he's sending his son to come get you. We're sitting on the precipice, I believe, of the next great event in Christian history. The next thing to happen is he comes to get his church. Now, what happens if you die before he comes to get his church? That's okay, too. You'll rise up out of your grave to go with us. Those of us who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with those that were dead to go meet him in the air. And I don't know which one of those two groups I prefer. I like the instantaneous church group, but it would also be kind of fun to burst up out of your grave. Either one of those sounds like a good time. I remember talking to DJ Ward once. David Morris and I were talking with DJ, and DJ said, I want that feeling. I want to burst up out of my grave. And I said, no, I want that feeling of instant change. I want to hear the voice. I want to hear the trumpet and be instantaneously changed from corruptible to incorruptibility. He said, no, I want to come up out of my grave. And I said, well, then you come up out of your grave, and David and I will be standing there going, well, how was it? And then we'll all go to be with the Lord. The good news is we're all going to be with the Lord. And this time that we have to spend down here is just occupying till he comes. Praising him and worshiping him in the meantime, and then go.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.